While this is waiting, I'd like to thank the caucus for continuing to invite me, even though I politely disagree with, you know, some of the positions of some of the individuals. I also want to thank the Army Reserve also for its very forward-thinking and progressive continuing health education program, which enables us to get out to professional medical conferences and share best practices and thoughts with you all. I have nothing to disclose as far as financial interests, and this is a disclaimer that the opinions expressed are those of my own and not the Department of Defense, the Army, or the United States Army Medical Department. Just a quick overview. I'm just going to set up how this issue interested me. Actually, the germ of it came about 4 years ago in 2007. I was in San Antonio at the Army Medical Department's Officer Advanced Course for Reserve Officers, which had Reserve and Guard officers from coast to coast. And during one of the lunches, I was speaking with an officer from the North Dakota Army National Guard, talking about the tremendous burden and the reintegration issues that they're having up in North Dakota. And it came out that there were 3,100 Army Guardsmen in North Dakota, a state less than 700,000 people. My home state of New York has authorized barely over 9,000 with 19 million people. So that just kind of tees up some of this deployment burden, if you will. Quick overview of the reserve component. As you know, each one of the military services has a reserve component. We also have the Army National Guard, which comes out of our nation's longstanding citizen soldier militia heritage. Although it is a state agency, it is funded to the order of 97-98% by federal dollars. It's bound by federal regulations from the National Guard Bureau as well as the Department of Defense. And there is a difference between the Army Reserve and the Army National Guard. Since the early 1990s, the Army Guard is primarily, not exclusively, but primarily combat formations, infantry, aviation, artillery, armor, whereas the Army Reserve, which I'm a member of, is more of strategic logistics, medical assets, postal units, military police, things like that. And taken together, that's what the reserve component is. Historically, as you know, certainly since World War II, basically the reserve component was a strategic reserve. The primary mission of the Army Guard and the Army Reserve was to be that strategic backfill as we expanded the Army, probably through an augmentation of the draft. The Air Reserve and the Air Guard have pretty much always had some type of operational role in small numbers, a certain number of airframes going to support an active duty mission, small numbers of people, smaller numbers of planes, kind of repetitively on recurring missions. But the Army Guard and the Reserve really got into more of an operational role in the 90s, but these were fairly small scale. I was in the National Guard in college during the 90s, and with these Bosnia missions, Kosovo, often just being a full-time college student would be enough to pretty much get an exemption from the deployment if it even interfered with a semester. My, how times have changed. But post 9/11, we certainly saw the Guard and Reserve from the very beginning. I mean, we're relied on for some very unforeseen personnel requirements. Army National Guard units, the Florida National Guard, Indiana Guard, they were on the ground going over the line of departure into Iraq on day one of the invasion. So an integral part of that, very high operational tempo and personnel tempo. And interesting thing on that bottom slide, I'm currently a member of the Individual Ready Reserve right now. That is really our tertiary strategic reserve, and we had tapped into that basically by June of 2004 just to meet recurring personnel requirements in Iraq. Now, with this change, certainly some very senior policymakers kind of, I think, had, this is my opinion, maybe gone taking that Rahm Emanuel adage of never let a crisis go to waste. And so this was a chance to kind of maybe re-vector in their minds to continue budget reasons and maybe or the primacy of the mission of transitioning from the part-time citizen soldier to this, their term, not mine, warrior citizen. This is a quote from our current chief of the Army Reserve. And you can see just in some visuals here, that's Army Reserve magazine from 2002, and by 2008 we were seeing a lot of these, you know, very Leni Riefenstahl-inspired kind of pictures. And there was a real paradigm shift, as I said. The operational reserve kind of became a new term. This wasn't a stopgap measure. No, this was going to be kind of the way things were going to be in the future. The 2006 and 2010 quadrennial defense reviews had brought this into question, and the Army developed something which it currently implementing called the R4Gen model, which basically, even at the conclusion of Iraq and Afghanistan, the expectation, if the funding is there, that this would be a perpetual, every fifth year, a reserve or guard unit would be mobilized in some capacity. And the Army Reserve leadership is currently seeking statutory authorities to expand their access to the reserve pool. Right now, a presidential declaration is required to access federalize the National Guard for overseas deployment and to call up the Army Reserve. But this would enable a lower threshold of clearance through Secretary of Defense or Secretary of the Army to be able to call up the reserve components. And that's just a visual of the R4Gen style, basically that fifth year available. It would be this perpetual every fifth year. Now, teeing this up, we have to look at some of the migration that's happened. When the draft ended in 1973, there was a doctrine from General Abrams, and it's called the Abrams Doctrine, where basically never again would we go to war without the reserve and guard having some role. And without the draft, without a at least regionally reflective conscription regime, the guard and the reserve would be the sinews that would connect civil society to the military. That was the plan. But over the past four decades, we've seen an accelerating trend, and certainly manifested through the most recent Base Realignment and Closure Commission, of moving reserve and guard forces and personnel and billets to the South, but also very much to rural states. And we're at the point right now where the Army Guard does not reflect the geographic population of the United States. And this is just a quick visual. This is, just so you can see, this is adjusted per 10,000. This is a very crude estimate, but you can see North Dakota, South Dakota, I mean, we're looking at 45, 50 per 10,000 authorizations for the Army Guard, California, New York, you know, barely five. This is just, these are uniques. This is the unique deployed individuals by reserve component. The Army National Guard has really borne the lion's share of that. Again, combat units primarily, almost half of all mobilized and deployed reservists are the Army Guard. The reason it adds up to more than 120% is a little technicality. The Coast Guard actually falls under the Department of Homeland Security, so that's the 0.20 plus up. They're not DOD. Now, this is the map that you may have seen or people have seen, the red being a very heavy density, the lighter colors being lower density of overall reserve deployments. Looks like what you would expect with large population centers in the Northeast and California, but this does not tell the true story because it's not adjusted for population. This tells more of the true story. This is the estimated Guard and Reserve deployed per 10,000. Again, a tremendous burden there. South Dakota, Mississippi, North Dakota, Arkansas, really, you know, six, seven, five times, you know, California, New York, and Texas. And again, even within an individual state, this is a very telling story, and this is, you know, maybe one of my disagreements with, you know, some of the verbiage in the caucus. This is New York State. This is the estimated Guard and Reserve deployed per 10,000. And yes, it looks like Brooklyn for Peace may be achieving one of their goals with having them below state average, but someone has to go, and it looks like, you know, it's inescapable to conclude that the folks from Watertown and Clinton County, which are Plattsburgh, are really, those communities are taking a hell of a hit. And this is Army Guard, again, mostly combat units. This is a few selected counties, and this isn't a parlor trick. I mean, some of these are fairly substantial counties within these states. Burleigh County, North Dakota is where Bismarck is situated. Pennington County, South Dakota is Rapid City. Story County, Iowa is just north of Des Moines. Benton County, Arkansas is about 200,000 people up by Bentonville, Arkansas, and up in Fayetteville. So this is just an example. And this really is a rural-urban-suburban dichotomy. And I want to point that Dallas, Texas, it's not a red state, blue state thing. Don't fall into that paradigm. It really is these rural communities with tremendous deployment burden, because as you can see, Dallas actually has a lower, deployment ratio, or if you will, than Boston, which is Suffolk County, Massachusetts. Challenges facing reserve and guard personnel. Boy, that's been amply covered by presenters probably more qualified to talk about this than me. But we've certainly seen there was a study in 2009 in the peer-reviewed journal Military Medicine, a small study in the Midwest, 41% of returning Army Guard personnel, only 41% were employed within 45 to 60 days of coming home. And we can imagine that could potentially be worse at this point. This is an estimate from some clinical social workers from the Army Reserve, that about 30% of Army Reserve and 20% of Guard personnel have no civilian medical insurance of any kind. And also those who do have TRICARE, the military health insurance, during the deployment, or reservists who now can pay out of pocket after they come home to continue that coverage, have very, very limited access in some of these rural areas. And then the suicides. The combined Army, National Guard, and Reserve suicides were 145 during 2010, and that was up from 80 in 2009. And in July 2001, I don't have the 2011 numbers, but July 2011 was really a record-breaking one. Now, this is the HRSA mental health provider shortage areas. I think this is very important, and I don't have the PowerPoint skills to have done a true, you know, ratio analysis by county. But had you done that, it would very nicely overlay the areas of the country that have this tremendous, you know, per 10,000 deployment burden with the areas where there is an acute and recognized shortage of mental health providers. Returning reserve personnel have great behavioral health needs. Again, these have been covered. Basically, when this was a study that appeared in JAMA during 2007, there was an immediate upon redeployment assessment, and then there was a reassessment 6 months later. And then, you know, things had manifested themselves very much between the initial assessment and the reassessment 6 months later. The depression rate during that six-month interim doubled in active duty to 10%, but tripled in the reserve component to 13%. At the end of the day, the authors had found that 20.3% of active duty and 42.4% of reserve component were identified as needing mental health treatment post-deployment. And this dovetails in here with PTSD. They had a four-point scale. Once you hit three, that was the threshold for the PTSD screen. And immediately coming home, a reserve component were slightly higher than their regular Army counterparts. But by 6 months later at the reassessment, it jumped to 9.1% of active duty and 14.3% of the reserve. And the rate of new positive PTSD screens was accelerated more rapidly in the reserve. What are some possible contributing factors to this? Some of these are the authors, and some of these have I come with. Active duty is really, in the best sense of the world, a total kind of socialist institution. Again, I say that in the best sense of the word. I mean, it really is from each according to their ability to each according to their needs. I mean, there is full health insurance, whether you have five kids or eight. You know, I mean, it's fully covered, non-contributory retirement plan, all these kinds of things. And so they have ready access to those. A mobilized reservist has those benefits while they're deployed for the family, and 6 months after they come back. But after that, the TRICARE falls away. And as we saw in that previous slide with the study, more than half of those reserve soldiers looked at 6 months later had already fallen off TRICARE, had already fallen off military health coverage. The VA has very generously, through congressional appropriation, extended benefits, no questions asked, to all coming home Iraq and Afghanistan veterans for 5 years after separation. But there may be a pressure to keep the benefits, to keep that health insurance. So there is a potential that people could be putting in claims just in the hopes of being found service-connected to be keep getting the benefits. You know, the reserve component lacks a day-to-day support from the deployment cohort, very dissimilar from active duty, where at least, you know, you're coming home and working every day with the folks you went with. And this is especially acute among IRR personnel who are really pulled and recalled out of civilian life, put in with a unit of strangers, go away for a year, come back, and then go back to their civilian lives. And cross levels, that's basically what we've had to do to fill out a lot of units. I mean, you will see Army Reserve companies deploying to Afghanistan. 120 soldiers may be drawn from 17, 18, over 20 states just to pull these people together to form a deployable unit. And then there's the added stress, especially in this economy, of the transition back to civilian employment. What's done is done. We can't unring this bell, but we do have to try to do something for these services. They have made valiant, valiant efforts. And I do see it with Department of Defense, VA, and state and community partners, you know, trying to, you know, pull this together at the local level. There's a congressionally funded organization out of the University of North Carolina. I commend you to their website, the Citizen Soldier Support Program. That's where I got a lot of my data from. And they have training, and they're trying to basically recruit and train civilian providers to kind of fill those gaps. Again, it's an uphill climb when there's areas that are already are shortage areas to begin with. And we do need a public health approach focused on prevention and resilience going forward. This is just, I'm going to go through this real quick. Oh, I think I already went through that one. Okay. Where do we go from here? This is just kind of my last, you know, full slide. Basically, before any new statutory authorities, any loosening of the ability to call the reserves, I think that a full analysis should be conducted. Basically, what has been the impact over the past decade and the impact on families, personnel, and the force as a whole? There's a very seductive thing in the second bullet in this budget environment of, well, you know, the reserve is, you know, depending on the estimate, one-fifth or one-sixth is expensive per soldier than the full-timers. Let's just, you know, cut the full-time down and shift these missions over to the reserve guard. And there is talk about that in the Army of moving more of our armor units, our tanks, and mechanized infantry into the Army National Guard. But as I hopefully can see, there are costs to that, too. And it's not just the top line, how much does a soldier cost per annum? The civil military implications of a geographically and culturally unrepresented reserve force structure are overdue for national discussion. Again, this was an organization, one of the precepts of the all-volunteer force was that the Guard was going to be, again, that those sinews holding the country to the military, and as you can see, it may not be the case. And a geographically representative National Guard can enhance civil-military relations, best leverage the unique talents of America's citizenry, and ensure an adequate source of manpower in a domestic emergency. When you tease out the New York City boroughs, they do not have the force structure that the other states do in the event of a hurricane or some type of mandatory evacuation. And I just want to, as always, do dedicate the talk to the men of the 2nd and 14th Infantry. This was the unit I served with on active duty. And thanks for letting me talk.